Tonight, we're really excited to talk advanced stats with Parker Fleming. And looks like he's been at it. Thanks, guys. Do we have you? Hey, Parker, can you hear me?
I can. I don't
Oh,
know why
great. Great. Excellent.
Spaces
Hey,
turns
there we
everybody
go.
into a boomer, I swear.
Well, Parker, it is awesome to have you on with our show for this week. If you don't know already, Parker is a really big rising star when it comes to advanced statistics and analysis in college football. You may have read some of his stuff over on Football Outsiders. He's currently the GM of RPM Data. And of course, if you are a TCU fan, such as myself, a graduate of TCU, you probably know him from the Purple Theory podcast. Absolutely have to plug that. He does a lot of work with CFB graphs, and he's kind of a college football nomad from all over the place. You've probably seen some kind of his work somewhere. And Parker, we're really glad to have you on today.
Well, yeah, guys, I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for saying all that. I will plug real quick to just the BetUS College Football Show. Find that channel on YouTube. You can see it linked in my profile, I think. That's the other place that you can find me this fall as well.
Fantastic. Well, hey, we're talking advanced statistics today. Let's just start with a very broad overview and just a basic 101. We hear advanced statistics and we see the nerds on Twitter get really big into it, but what exactly is advanced statistics and how does it help us understand college football better?
Yeah, so advanced statistics just basically is a really fancy way to say statistics that are just one level a little bit deeper. So you think about kind of the basics, I call them the caveman stats of the total yards and touchdown to interception ratio and total catches and some of these kind of baseline stats provide you some information, but there's a lot of context that is obscured in some of those higher level aggregate stats. And so advanced stats just refers to kind of a method of thinking about sports in general and football in specific that looks at how do we adjust for context and situation to glean a better understanding of what's actually happening on the field, knowing that even if you grind film all weekend, your eyes cannot process and your brain cannot form inferences about every single play. You can't take in all that information and then make meaningful inferences. And so advanced stats just helps us look at everything that happened and look at everything that happened in a meaningful way to make better inferences about what happened or what is going to happen in a game.
So when you say better inferences, what are some of those, like, I guess the first building blocks for getting above the caveman stats and into some of those better inferences? Would this necessarily be, yards per play? Would that be points per game? What are some of that, like, really nice, if you haven't dipped into it before and you're trying to get used to it, what are like some good, very beginner advanced stats you should be looking at?
Okay. What just happened? Am I here? I'm sorry. This is terrible audio.
Yeah, you're
Okay,
here.
great.
I'm not
Sorry.
quite sure what
Yeah,
happened there,
something.
Parker. Yeah, I was like, I think everybody wondered if it was on their side, but we can hear you,
Great,
Parker.
great,
Go
great.
right ahead.
So the best example that I have in my recent memory, just kind of off the top of my head, for why we should think about advanced statistics and then kind of how we think about advanced statistics is the Duke Mayo Bowl from 2020. Wisconsin played Wake Forest, and Wake Forest outgained Wisconsin 518 yards to 266 yards. Wake Forest outgained Wisconsin. Wisconsin won that game 42 to 28, and it wasn't close. And so that's a good example of where, oh, we need to dive into a little bit more of these advanced metrics, and we need to kind of understand what's going on. If I'm looking, just box score hunting, right? Because I do a lot of stuff in R and I do a lot of my analysis myself, and people ask, hey, where can I find that? And I'm like, well, in my brain, like I create all that those stats and kind of put them out there. But if you're just looking at the box score, how do I know what's going on? The first thing you start is look at kind of the yards per play and see which direction those go, or that goes, and then look at turnovers. And sometimes
you'll see those go in opposite directions, and that'll explain a lot of what happens there. But the first thing to do, I think, is adjust for plays and then look at turnovers, because again, I can outgain you by gaining 99 yards every drive. But if I fumble at the 1 yard line and don't score, I'm not going to win. Yards per play is a fine kind of broad brush to adjust to what's happening. And then turnovers just give you a good indicator at the very basic level of who one got some luck, but also who maybe wasted more drives. My biggest kind of wonky analytics idea is that football is actually a lot more like bowling than we want to admit, because it doesn't always work out like this, but generally you get a turn, I get a turn, you get a turn, I get a turn, back and forth for that, 9 to 12 possessions generally every game. And so looking at yards per play tells me a baseline, how efficient are you? And then turnover says, how many opportunities did you waste or did you get? And those two things are kind of my if I'm just box score hunting, I'm not getting into the data and creating anything. Those two are my kind of go-tos as a way to better understand, hey, like exactly in this Duke's Mayo Bowl, Wake Forest got a lot more yards. Well, what happened? Why didn't Wisconsin beat them? Well, because Wisconsin's offense was super efficient. They just got the ball at like the 30 every time because Wake Forest just kept handing them the ball on offense.
So turnovers would obviously be one huge one when you're trying to determine what a game would look like. But if you had something like that, are turnovers considered a random statistic? Is this something, when we say that we can have an inference, can we anticipate a team will have X amount of turnovers? Or is that more along the lines of a frame in a game of bowling of, we know someone didn't get the scoring opportunity and that led to the end of a possession?
Yeah, so when we talk about random, we say the word random for meaning a lot of different things. And so I like to be a little bit careful there. Turnovers are random in kind of two senses. One, they're random in the fact that they're not year-to-year stable. A team that's high turnovers 1 year is not going to be high turnovers the next year, generally. Obviously, there's outliers, but and I think there's some coaches who really preach and try and implement the fact that they can force turnovers as a replicable skill. But generally, turnovers are not year-to-year standard or year-to-year consistent, which means there is a lot of randomness. There's a lot of variation in kind of what happens. Also, turnovers are random because in a lot of public data for college football, we don't have any observational data about near misses, right? With play-by-play, we've just recently started getting better information about almost turnovers on forced fumbles. And so we can see when the ball hits the ground. But in terms of close interceptions or bad decisions by the quarterback, a lot of that is not necessarily public data and not very common. And so when we look at turnovers, we are missing a lot of information. So they are random just because we don't have a lot of good information about the counterfactual of, oh, this play would have been a turnover, but, or this was a complete fluke. In the play-by-play data, the quarterback taking a snap and falling down and throwing the ball over his head out of the back of the end zone is really similar to the quarterback taking a snap and running 99 yards out of the back of the end zone the other direction. Those are observationally equivalent to some extent. And so the randomness of turnovers, it really comes down to football is a game of opportunity, and turnovers are correlated with opportunity, but they are also pretty unstable from year to year.
That kind of reminds me of Manti Te'o's final season at Notre Dame, when he was, garnering a lot of push for various defensive awards and, maybe even a Heisman campaign. And a lot of attention was paid to his interceptions, which, I mean, for a linebacker, that's not really something that we would normally say, okay, yeah, you don't have enough interceptions to really qualify for this. But for some reason, it was getting a lot of talking points because he had quite a few. But if you went back and you actually looked at the plays, a lot of them were just crazy flukes of deflections off of someone else. And he just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And, that's kind of why that was just totally way out of the ballpark from like his past performances and things. But you can't glean that just from looking at the box score or looking at stats on paper without, some kind of a quality aspect to it that's coming from a subjective person, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there, there's an economic adage, and economics is my background. That's like no theory without evidence and no evidence without theory. And so that's kind of the same thing with football, is like no data without film, but no film without data. You need both in certain proportions. That Teo example is really great, because I think if we're talking about the same thing, he had a couple interceptions that were in high leverage moments against Michigan in a win that year. And that's a great example of how using data to aggregate and process and using analytics to look at all of the data across all scenarios helps us kind of correct a bias, which in college football, a lot of people watch and they think mostly about big moments and what they remember in big moments. And so because Teo had two interceptions against Michigan, even though his total was 7 and a lot of those were flukes, it stands out a lot more in someone's mind than, you know, a lot of other players who may have had interceptions in less lower leverage situations, even if they were more impressive athletically or in terms of scheme or how the game was played. They, you know, those big leverage moments get way outweighed in our minds.
Is there a, you know, I've heard some statisticians try to quantify this and make it a measurable by looking at a thing like, you know, something like havoc rate of, you know, defenses that are more likely to put themselves into position to cause, you know, some kind of an instability in the game, whether that's forced fumbles or interceptions, sacks, kind of just whatever, you know, throw a wrench into the gearbox, basically. Do you think that that's more of a kind of like that holistic approach is better at trying to take out some of the variation that we see?
I certainly like that kind of like the idea behind that grouping of, hey, these different plays are actually similar under a common theme, and grouping them together helps us get some better inference. I think Michael Felder recently was looking at talking about how this ball, he's just going to track negative plays. And so he's not going to worry about like success rate, but just say like, did you go backwards or do something stupid? And I think that can be really helpful, especially because the big deal with football is that it's not discrete. It's a continuous game, and there aren't a lot of discrete actions in that continuous game that are measurable. So if we can look at some of those discrete actions and say, oh, if these are generally similar and generally correlated or predictive of future defensive success, these are a good barometer for kind of how a defense is performing. And so I like that havoc rate. I get a little bit wary of individual statistics, especially at college football, even more so than the NFL, just because, again, there's so much scheme that goes into where a player is and the opportunities a player has. That evaluating them is often really evaluating kind of how a team sets up a player for success, not just how that player capitalizes on opportunities for success.
Right, like a Darrell Revis is going to skew your secondary stats just by his mere presence on the field, versus, you know, if you've got somebody who's worse than the average, or you've got a hole in your defense somewhere that the other team can take advantage of.
Yeah, so a lot of like cornerbacks, I think, are great. That's an excellent example. Like, basically, for cornerbacks, you don't really care about like pass breakups or interceptions. You care about like targets per snap, because most of the time in college football, there's a talent asymmetry in the secondary. And so, if teams are throwing away from you, that's a pretty good indicator that you're pretty disruptive and a pretty big force for the pretty big force for the defense. Even if your kind of raw stats might not look as appealing as the other ones do.
I'm curious to know, when you start seeing things like a havoc rate or a stop rate or some other calculated theory with the evidence, what's your general approach to looking at evidence in general and then building a theory off of that evidence?
Yeah, so my theory is Saturday night, as games are winding down and we're watching the crazy Pac-12 game, let's go ahead and pull and scrape data. And then I just kind of pardon my informality here, but I just kind of open a beer and start poking and prodding the data and seeing what happens. So I generally have a standard box score of advanced stats that I think these correlate well to success. And if these are out of line with the game results, that gives me an indicator that I should go and dive deeper into a specific game. One thing that I've started to look at recently is kind of the distribution of big plays. And so you'll see me talk a lot about like on these, you know, I don't have a specific example off my head, but it's like, you know, Baylor against Iowa State, Baylor gained 80% of their yards on 20% of their plays to start the game. And then they gained, you know, the inverse of that for the rest of the game. So there's a really high concentration of where they were successful. And then Iowa State kind of clamped him down, but it wasn't enough time, enough for them to come back. And so those kind of distributional statistics, I think, are really good ways to start to think about, hey, did a team have consistent success against an opponent, or was it just bunched up against certain, was it a blown coverage? I think at one point, I won't put any college athletes specifically on blast, but I'll say a general example there for TCU. They had a backup on defense, and a friend of mine were tracking the number of big rushing plays that TCU gave up where that backup was in. And there's a lot of them. It was a very high proportion. And so that informs us about a team. And, you know, we see, hey, TCU's giving up a lot of big runs. That's a really bad thing that's really bringing them down success-wise. Well, oh, okay, if that's really out of line with what my expectation is, then we can go in and kind of see and diagnose why that might be happening. So, I mean, I really just start, again, yards per play, turnovers, and then I start to look at third down success, even before I pull up something like EPA, which I'm sure we'll talk about, or even echo rate, looking at third down success and just saying, hey, was this an extreme value? Did a team have a really good run on third downs, or could they just not get a third down at all against an opponent? You look at the SEC championship last year, Georgia versus Alabama. One of Georgia's weaknesses coming into that game was third down success. And they started the game against Alabama, I think 3 for 7 on third downs. I don't care what you do for field position or the rest of it. Like, if you just can't convert third downs, you're going to have a hard time. And so that explained a lot of the difference in success in that game, specifically related to a game where it kind of turned out a lot different than a lot of people's expectations.
Similarly, with when it comes to actual theory, I'm trying to think more on an anecdotal level. I'm trying to think more when you say, you know, you see TCU has the backup player, and then that normally correlates with a bigger run. Is there a way that you could look at maybe like a full narrative and then try to either back up or disprove something with the evidence? Like, I think immediately of like Matt Ariza, the punter at San Diego State, getting the moniker of the punt god. How could advanced statistics help prove or disprove a narrative like that?
Yeah. So in the In the punt god example, I mean, you can very easily go and get the data and say, let me adjust punts for field position, right? That's just like an immediate, easy step to do. Because if I'm always punting from the 50, there's a hard cap on the distance of punting I can do, right? Like, if I punt from the 50, I literally cannot punt it further than 50 yards meaningfully. And so I have to adjust for, well, if I'm punting from the 50, I'm not trying to kick it as far as I can. I'm trying to place it where I want to go. And so even a stat that's a little bit wonkier, that like punt yards per punt or even net yards per punt, is going to be influenced by where you're punting from on the field. And so to confirm a narrative like that, that I would say, hey, this is interesting. You know, I'll see a tweet. I'll like a tweet or bookmark a tweet and say, someone made a claim that's interesting. That's changed the way that I think about the game. Let me test that with evidence. Is specifically in the punt god example, I would go and say, all right, let's look at the average field position that he's punting from compared to some of the other people who are close to him in punt distance. And let's just throw that on a scatter plot and say, oh, I can kind of compare and contrast. My expectation would be if he's the punt god, he's going to have the highest average distance. But if he doesn't have the higher average distance, then I can say, oh, maybe it's because his field position is different because San Diego State's offense wasn't that efficient last year. And he wasn't in a context where he needed to punt the ball as far as possible every time. Or it could be the case that he has a lower yards per punt or a higher yards per punt. And that's because they were all starting, you know, at their own 20. And so he was just booting the ball. And maybe that isn't as indicative of punt efficiency or punt strategy. This is why I do a preview for every game, right? Is because you need concrete expectations. You need some narrative. Even if it's wrong, I like a good fixed point going into a game because I can say, hey, reasonably, a team with this stat profile versus another team with this stat profile should behave this way. And then if it doesn't, I can learn something. I think it was FAU Charlotte last year. I had that game by like 1 point. This was my biggest miss all season. I think Louisiana Monroe Liberty was my biggest miss all season, but these two were very similar games, FAU Charlotte. And I had it like within 1 point and FAU won by a couple scores. Charlotte had a first down inside the FAU 40 like three times. They got 0 points. That's just crazy. That's super out of line with their rates and super out of line with kind of average and historical performance. And so I got to go back to that game and immediately find those drives and watch them and say, oh, yeah, their offensive line got blown up on a first down on all three of those drives. And then they were, you know, second and 12. That explains why it was different than my expectation. So having a reasonable expectation gives you kind of a barometer to compare against reality. Then you start poking and prodding the data and kind of understanding why is what I expected different from reality. Then you learn something.
Parker, how do you think media can tell better narratives with advanced stats like these?
I think that that's a great question. And I like that question a lot because there's a lot of just, hey, let me throw some numbers out there and hope that, you know, the position coach retweets this or hopes that fans catch hold of this and it kind of takes off. I think that the biggest thing to do is either find someone who's pretty smart about this or even, you know, pick up a pen and paper and do a little bit of this for yourself. So I think things like writing down concrete projections for win totals at the beginning of the season is a great exercise for everyone who's involved with college football. You don't have to be a betting person. You don't have to be a sharp. You don't have to say, hey, I'm going to start my website or release picks and try and make money off of it. Just say, hey, I'm interested in the game. Let me rank the quarterbacks in the Big 12 going into the fall, just so I have some reasonable expectation. If you start to do stuff like that and you start to think, what is a consistent algorithm in my head, not a mathematical formula, whatever, just saying, hey, when I'm ranking these quarterbacks or I'm trying to pick these win totals, what are the common themes I'm thinking of? You start to create a mental model and you can formalize those. That's just a better way to think about how you're thinking about college football. It's this kind of, I'm going to drop a $5 word here, but it's this, this metacognition of like, how am I thinking about how I'm thinking about things? And that is a big deal with media specifically. It's the fact that numbers are so available now that having numbers is not enough. You have to know what they're saying, and you have to have some kind of reasonable expectation to either say I'm supporting or disproving a specific claim using this consistent method and using these numbers. I also think that the flip side of that is, you know, probably there's a lot of burden on people like me and a lot of people who I see are in this chat right here who do great work to say, hey, we need to go out of our way to almost like court and woo people who don't understand or who are opposed to using numbers and saying, hey, the point of this is not for me to say, hey, I'm really smart and I took a bunch of math classes and I stay up late at night and waste all my time building this stuff in R. The point of these are to say, hey, we can think about football in a more interesting way. We can fix ideas and kind of compare to reality and maybe get some more insight. So I think it's a twofold problem of one, not really knowing why we're using numbers, but then also maybe failing a little bit on that kind of education and courtship of the median or the modal college football fan who, you know, might be opposed to using those numbers.
So if we're talking about media and narratives and how it interacts with advanced stats, you know, we have to invoke Charles Barkley when it comes to analytics and the narrative of, you know, does it work? Does it not work? And, you know, there have been some pretty famous cases in the NBA, especially, which has become very analytics driven, where the analytics didn't line up with what happened in the game in very high profile games. Obviously sample size matters and you're going to have variation, you know, in a single game, single event. How do we reconcile what the analytics, what the advanced stats tell us to expect with what we actually see? You know, you mentioned the one game in particular from last season, but how do we interpret that? And then how do we, you know, explain it to other people in terms of the stats weren't wrong. It's just, you know, crazy things still happen because humans are involved.
Yes. So I think I'll say two things and then answer that question. One, I prefer the Booger McFarland stats are for losers reference, and I just needed to bring that up while we're in here. two, a thing media can do, and then I'll go into this, is stop talking about fourth down decisions. Just shut up about it. It just doesn't. It's gets blown way out of proportion, and it is a huge source of argument between serious film guys I respect on Twitter and serious analytics guys I respect on Twitter, and I think it's exhausting. I think it's a reductive point and just gets us nowhere. So that's my New Year's resolution, is shut up about fourth down decisions, because there are ways to solve it and ways to attack it. But, it is a super unproductive destruction and discussion. And it really takes away from a lot of what we are, what we should be focusing on, which is the game of football generally. As far as kind of understanding, and you said a phrase there that really caught my mind, the stats weren't wrong. The whole point of this, and the whole thing we need to do, is kind of hedge and contextualize all of this in a posture of what I'm doing with statistics in football is not telling you what the future is going to be. It is creating reasonable expectations. Just went through this like nine or 10 rounds with a bunch of college baseball fans who are upset that their logo wasn't far enough on the left on the graph. But it's just saying what we're doing is we're taking a consistent method that has historically explained pretty well what's gone on with games, and then using that to create reasonable expectations and insight into games. So I think that's the biggest thing, is there is not this attitude of stats are not wrong, stats are not right. And that's a real temptation when you put numbers out there. Man, when you know, especially I do that Bet US show and we make 8 picks and shoot, I have a 7-1 week and it's like, hot damn, I'm a genius. And you have to kind of fight that instinct, because one, you're going to have to answer for the inevitable 2-6 week. But two, it's not a matter of I want to get these right so people think I know the future and so people think I'm smart. It's, hey, I want to apply this method and understand the game better. So you really have to couch it in some intellectual humility there. And you also have to be wary of, not in the betting space, we have to set that aside, but you have to be wary of analytics people touting a pretty extreme record. And pretty extreme results. And you just have to say, hey, what, like, am I understanding the game? I think the flip side is that is, I mean, there, I've seen a bunch of, let's use a machine learning model, which is, you know, basically a black box. And I just throw all these variables in the computer. I let them tell me what is most important to winning a game. And I can't really explain that process, but I get a good against the spread record. I think we also have to be able to explain what we're doing and not just sit on kind of an ivory tower of, I'm using math, I'm using advanced stats. I really try to be as stupid as possible in every stat that I put out there. And sometimes I get lost in my own brain and I'm very obviously verbose and distracted. And I will say some things that might not be straightforward and simple. But I think the simpler, the more precise of an insight, the better. And you couch that in some intellectual humility of, hey, you know what? If every single one of my predictions is wrong, that doesn't matter to me. Because I've learned something about either how I'm thinking about the game and creating a model, or how the game worked and why it was different from my expectations.
This is Reddit RCFB Talk 45, Advanced Stats and College Football with Parker Fleming, doing our quick little station ID at the 30-minute mark. And Parker, as we hit into the second half, I do want to ask, you had mentioned earlier we hadn't gotten into the betting sphere yet, and I'm very curious to know how one should take advanced statistics if they decide, hey, I'm going to go to Vegas and I'm going to make a lot of money on this. If you're using advanced statistics and you're trying to look at a model of, I could expect something like this in a matchup, it's not necessarily betting advice, but what is that use when it comes to the gambling space?
I try to tell people, because I do get a lot of people asking about it, and I do, I mean, I do make betting predictions, but I try to say that you should have a prior, if you're going to bet consistently, one, there's probably three phases to say here. One, if you have any level of desperation or distress about betting, stop betting. Don't do that. Let's talk about stats. Let's do something else. If you just want to go get drunk and go to Vegas with your friends and spend money and, you know, hope it hits, that's awesome. That's great. When I'm talking about betting, I'm talking specifically about having a bankroll before the season, pre-laying out, you know, here's what a unit is. A unit is what I'm going to bet on a game. So before the season, I say, hey, here's $1,000 that I've got set aside for college football this season. I'm going to bet in $20 units, and I'm going to stick to this system, whether I lose it all or whether I win big, right? So you got to have a bankroll in advance. If you're going to be betting systematically, and if you're going to be betting seriously, like that third category that I'm talking about, you should have a prior on every game before you consult sources. And so what I tell people to do is have a lean on a game and then look at my stats. If it confirms your prior, you know what, live your truth. You can use that and you can make that bet. If it goes against your prior, ask why and kind of push back. All it is, you know, the best way to get a right answer is to have the wrong answer, right? All it is an answer. And so I'm not advocating that you bet with my model every single game. I'm not advocating that you bet on every single game, but these do create reasonable expectations that historically perform very decently against the spread and should allow you to kind of test your presumptions and your prior assumptions against something else external and just kind of be oppressed there. I also think if you look at my stats previews, which will be coming back soon this fall as we have games, I really like to look at things like run pass splits. I think there's a lot of selection issues that we don't necessarily talk about well in college football. And so my preview might even, you know, if you don't like the number that I post, you might say, hey, this team has a really good rushing efficiency in terms of EPA or yards per play, but teams aren't really rushing against them because their pass defense is so bad. This might give me insight that this rushing team is going to do better than the spread here. So you can get some of those kind of next level insights that'll help you tweak your priors and be a more informed consumer of football, but also a strategist when it comes to gambling.
Parker, I've been meaning to ask, so can you tell us a little bit about RPM data? I know you're with it, or data, sorry, depends on who you're talking to. but I'd love to know more about it, and who do you work with?
Yeah, no, that's great. So this has been something that's been brewing for a little bit, you know, for a little while. Keegan Renaud is in here with me, and he's kind of the person who's been pushing us to do something formal and kind of assemble a group of minds to come together and actually get more into the space of helping teams, helping agents, and using our powers for good, as it were, a little less fan facing and a little more team facing. And so what RPM is effectively a football consulting group that works with teams and that works with agents kind of in two chambers. And so the space that works with agents has a really good system, a really good team of scouts that kind of combines data about historical draft results and contract results in the NFL with college production and kind of a bunch of really, really good film guys who have really good understanding of what it takes to compete and to succeed at the next level. We combine those powers and help agents make strategic decisions to not only sign successful players, but also sign players at the margin who are going to be game changers for what agents can do. A lot of these guys have limited pools of resources. And if they hit the jackpot with someone, that means that they can go sign, be a lot more aggressive. They can push up in draft spots and sign some of these guys a little more aggressively. So working with the agents is really fun and kind of a challenge to convince someone that you know what you're talking about and listen to what they're saying. But it's a really, really great tangible kind of rubber meets the road way to take what we think about football in terms of watching it and in terms of data, put those together, and then explain that to someone and say, hey, we're confident that this is going to be a good investment or a good decision, a good piece on a roster. And so that's been really, really fun. Working with teams, we from the high school and the college level, are creating data resources that allow coaches and staffs to be better informed about their own team and their opponents, and not have to work as much grinding away from film. We can turn around high school and college tape pretty dang fast and have a pretty insightful system for here is the basics, and then give these coaches interactive dashboards and visuals that we can then go and answer questions, kind of give insights, give recommendations. So it's really, really fun. I think we're calling it version 2.0 starting in August, and things are really taking off, which has been really, really great to see. And it's really, really exciting to get to take that step from posting graphs on Twitter and arguing about college football to helping coaches and agents and players make meaningful decisions about their careers and on-field actions.
When y'all are talking to these teams and these agents, at least in version 1.0 of RPM, have y'all noticed a trend of pain points or data that coaches and front office staff and agents are really clamoring for right now?
Yeah, so I think that this is cool. When I tell people what I do, I kind of give the example of like all these football guys are really smart. We know that, right? They're really smart in the domain of football, and they're really strapped for time. And so I've had a lot of conversations with football coaches who are like, hey, I have a really interesting question. I tried to download the PFF ultimate data and it was a million observations and I crashed my computer. Like, I don't know how to open a spreadsheet. And so we're working with smart guys who have smart questions who don't have the data skills or background. And so there's been a lot of reception to kind of transforming that data, one, with the turnaround and just helping them get that data faster, but then two, processing that and saying, here are, you know, kind of these important insights. I think that people want an edge, and people want to, these coaches specifically know that data is important and are receptive to good ideas. It definitely is kind of an argument in the sense of the formal sense of the word. It's not contentious, but we do have to communicate value and say, hey, when you're thinking about the game of football with all of your experience, let's just press and prod on a few things that we have data-based insights about, and then let's see how that helps you or how it doesn't. And so that's really good. And fortunately, I have Keegan who reins me in when I try and put, you know, too wonky of stats to coaches and get a little too esoteric. He helps me ground it with the football side of things. But it really is there is a serious hunger and thirst for data and evidence-based practice in football. And a lot of these coaches are really receptive. What's been fun is a lot of coaches that we've engaged, especially earlier on, when we were kind of forming our products, we talked to and said, what do you want? And they kind of said, we're not really sure. Like, we know we want something and we want to use data, but we don't really know what that means. So show us what you've got. And so that's been really, really fun to kind of get to sit and think deeply, not about, you know, how do I know how TCU and Baylor are going to play this weekend and what I should expect about that. But hey, if I was on TCU's team and I was trying to game plan against Baylor, what am I specifically going to do to get an edge in this matchup?
So I have a question, but before I do, I want to let our audience know we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions, just hit request and we'll try to get to some of those as well. But I'm curious, Parker, how did you get into this? What led you into kind of jumping down the rabbit hole of advanced stats?
Some say my entire life is jumping down rabbit holes. You can hear me talk and hear how hyperactive my brain is. And I had to take a bunch of math classes because I did a liberal arts undergrad. I majored in religion and then wanted to go back and get an advanced degree in economics and did not have any math classes. So I took like 8 math classes in 4 semesters to get a math emphasis, and while I was getting my master's, and while I was getting kind of bored with those and just kind of going outside of my mind, I started to think about how I can think about something a little more interesting in football. And really, I really started taking this seriously. I wanted to learn the programming language R. I knew this awful Stata, which is just a terrible, hideous beast of machinery to do statistical analysis, and I wanted to learn R. But I really used the stuff I was learning in math classes and thinking about kind of how we think about games. Of course, I got to shout out like Bill Conley and Brian Freemail. I both of those guys, super influential to me in terms of they created a model and talked about football in a certain way, which helped me see kind of how to think about creating a model and talking about football, and then say, here's where I agree with them, here's where I disagree with them, here's how I think about it differently, and kind of create and coalesce my own thing there. So entirely born of procrastination and a little bit of a hyperactive brain. And it's just, I mean, it's fun. I really have been super fortunate in my life to be able to kind of chase what is fun and chase what is interesting to me, and football and using data to better understand football has been something that has been rewarding and interesting to me. And it's just kind of been really awesome for me to be able to do this.
So let's say somebody else is going, hey, I'm starting to get into advanced statistics. I'm wanting to learn. I want to follow in similar footsteps. What would be your advice to that kind of person?
Yeah, dream bigger than being me. start a GitHub, post projects publicly, talk to smart people, post your stuff on Twitter, and don't create clickbait lists just for the engagement. Don't chase engagement. Ask and answer interesting questions, and then demonstrate that you know, one, that you can do replicable science. That's super important right now, is kind of that data and code of doing a project from start to finish, from raw data to a complete project. Go look at everybody who's won or placed in the Big Data Bowl and where they are now. Go look at guys like Tan Ho on Twitter, who just got hired by Zealous Analytics, who has been just a monster. He did streams and just posted all the time. And so I really think that the cool thing about a lot of open source data that the guys at CFB Faster are doing, for instance, for college football data, is that anybody can get access to that data, and there's a million tutorials online, and then you can post it and it'll be right up there. Literally, we live in an age where you like Sports Illustrated competes with you for clicks on Google and on Twitter. Like, you can go post right now. And so ask and answer interesting questions. Keep that air of intellectual humility, and just, again, have a GitHub, have some place to document your work, and make sure, look, it's great to like replicate people's work. That's a great place to start. Make sure you're differentiating yourself. Make sure you have your own flavor. You're asking your own questions, and you're creating your own products, and just say, hey, I want to think about how we think about sports. I want to use data to do it. I can present myself in a way that makes that attractive to people. And just start a Substack, start a blog, start a Twitter, post something.
Parker, shifting gears a little bit, looking forward to the 2022 college football season. Is there anything in particular that maybe has already kind of caught your eye of things to see? You know, is the team going to be able to replicate something that they did last year? Are they going to be able to improve? You know, some kind of an interesting trend to look for going into this season.
Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, I posted about like under and over performers in 2020 or 2021 rather, because I think that's super informative to just, again, look. Let's look at the record and let's look at the stats and kind of see who performed differently. And so I think the underperformers are super interesting because you can kind of highlight some teams that maybe had a bad rap last year and might bounce back this year. One I'll say, I don't release like a power ranking or a raw number. My matchup, my model is super matchup based, and I just don't find it informative to say, you know, Georgia's 20 points better than the average team and Alabama's 17, when if Georgia and Alabama played, I would have Alabama favored. You know, like I just don't feel like that's super informative and doesn't help anyone's understanding. So I don't have raw numbers for 2022. What I do have is looking back and saying, you know, the biggest difference between actual and expected wins is super informative. All I did was take Bill James' Pythagorean expectation for wins, map that into college football over a 12-game season. How many games plus or minus reality were you? And so like Nebraska was 4.45 games worse than their expectation. They underperformed by almost 4.5 games. That is not sustainable. They cannot lose that many one score games again, you would think.
Greatest 3-9 team ever.
Exactly. And so that is also a fun game. I think is Kelly Ford in here? Yeah, Kelly Ford is here. Kelly, you remember when we did that space and talked about Florida State for like 30 minutes last October? Because I just like to go on my website, cfb-grass.com, and like sort by EPA per play and then look at record, or like sort by record and see who had the highest EPA per play and like the worst record. And so I think that's like a good way to kind of look at it. Other teams that I think are standing out, Iowa State had a ton of returning production last year, had some really bad special teams issues, and was 2 wins under expected last year. I don't expect that to continue year over year in terms of outliers. Auburn underperformed by almost 2. They had some injury issues. There's a lot of narratives around them. That's another team I have circled as, hey, maybe things last year on the field weren't as bad as what the record shows. In terms of, narratives and things that are interesting, I think that the other day I tweeted about just trying to get ideas for who's going to have the biggest shift in scheme. And obviously, like I people want to talk about Jim Knowles to Ohio State and all that. I think it's really fun to look at a team like Colorado State, who underperformed by 1.76 wins last year, fire their coach, brings in an air raid coach, and doesn't have an air raid roster. That's the stuff that football is made for, man. Like, that's going to be wild. So when I think about this fall, I'm interested a lot in kind of weird situations like that, which will be one, or like a Southern Miss, who was an absolute disaster just from the standpoint of they had so many injuries at quarterback. They were playing running back Frank Gore, who I will note had a higher completion percentage than Texas's Casey Thompson last year as a quarterback. But a team like Southern Miss, where they don't really have, they did not have a lot of first level indicators of success last year because they had so many injury issues, but this year might be successful. Another thing I look at is like there are 22 teams, I think, that are returning quarterback and both coordinators. Those are teams combined with this underachieving data that I would go and look and say, ah, I'm pretty interested in who might succeed from these.
Yeah, but Southern Miss is going to eventually have to rely on one of those, Jugs football machines to be the quarterback and just have it chuck the ball every play. We have we've been welcoming callers, and Andrew has been patiently waiting. He'd love to ask a question. Andrew, do you want to unmute and ask a question for Parker?
Oh, yeah, no, thanks. I don't know if you guys can hear me, but
yeah.
Oh, we can hear you.
Right. Oh, hey. Yeah, thank you. So, Parker, I was going to ask you, so I've been following you on Twitter for a while, big TCU guy. I grew up loving LT, so I like TCU. I go to Illinois right now. But my question for you is, for somebody who does a lot of things internally for teams, I work for the women's basketball team and the football team, as well as right now I'm doing some work for the Pistons, and a lot of the work I do can't necessarily be posted online. And that's something that a lot of people who are trying to crack into the industry are, building up their GitHub or a profile portfolio and stuff like that. But a lot of the stuff I do, I can't necessarily post because it's all very sensitive team data. And so I guess I was asking you, somebody who does spend so much time on Twitter and knowing people in the industry as well, I guess, how could I be creative to show off some of the skills that I have without jeopardizing some of the teams that I work for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have an answer to that. But before I answer that, will you DM me? I'm going to connect you with someone that was an undergrad who I've talked to a bunch who worked for a team and did a really great job and now has and is now moved on in his career and done really well kind of leveraging that. Someone who's been in that exact situation, I'll connect you on Twitter. So DM me, because I'd love to do that. My answer there is kind of twofold. One, don't hear this as harsh as I'm saying, but like, who cares about online? You have jobs in sports. Like that's huge that you can do some of that work. And that might be a question to talk to a manager or direct supervisor of, not, hey, I don't want to post this on Twitter, but when I am interacting with potential future employers, what kind of portfolio can I create to show them? So I think that's a great question for a manager and kind of what's proprietary and what's not. On the flip side, pick a sport that's not any of those and just become obsessed with it online. Like, the soccer has amazing data, or I mean, like UFC has incredible like strike by strike data or something. It just Nick Wan, WAN, works for the Reds and does a bunch of live streams, and like he will go do, he can't do anything with baseball online, like has a contract, but he'll go do like professional bull riding data set and stuff. So you can do plenty of data and sports analysis outside of your subject area. And so I think that would be kind of an avenue to pursue with that, as well as talking to your manager. But DM me and I'll connect you with somebody undergrad who might be able to answer that a little more specifically.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. I really appreciate the help. Thank you guys again for hosting this. I know that a lot of college football fans out there really like these spaces. So I just want to say thank you for that too.
Absolutely. Thanks for your question, man.
I'm sorry, Parker, did you say that there are PBR bull riding advanced stats?
Okay, I'm so excited that I get to talk about this on air. Yes, there are PBR stats. Nick Wan created a bull riding model. We've played around with it for a little bit. We actually got to the point of like talking to clients about like using a mixed effect model to figure out which bull to buy. And like he went way down this rabbit hole. It was incredible and so silly and so fun. PBR, professional bull riding. This all started because I tweeted about being at the rodeo. And then we found a guy like at PBR stats or something. And he had some data, and then we found some better data, and then made like this, Nick made this incredible like hierarchical model that gave, that rated riders and bulls. It was awesome. It was so fun.
I mean, that's fascinating. I work in agriculture, and I mean, we track stats on, you know, stats, genetics for so many species and everything. But, you know, obviously there's an aspect of breeding to trying to breed better bulls. And there's a lot of money in it for these high performing PBR bulls, but actually being able to break it down as advanced stats, because I mean, it is technically a sport, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I mean, I've been in like a ag econ seminar where we talked about like the sensitivity of estimates on the efficacy of like artificial insemination. I mean, these people go insane on some of this data stuff, but this was like for the bull, this was specifically about like bulls and riders in the ring. I mean, there's just, again, if you can get data on something, you can ask and answer interesting questions kind of anywhere.
So Walter, I know you've also been waiting to ask a question. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I root for a team that's not a perennial power. It's got peaks and troughs. Is there like a smart advanced stat to kind of watch for, or small set of stats to watch for that? Yeah, maybe we're just squeaking by now, but things are trending up. Or conversely, hey, we're winning, but holy crap, there's cracks in the foundation.
Yeah, so in a college football sense, one, what's up, McWalt? Two, I apologize for talking about artificial insemination earlier. I realized that was probably off the rails. Three, answering that question, I think that that's a good way to look at, that's a good way to think about games. So for instance, a game that was really, a team that gave a lot of people a lot of ammo to kind of throw at me was Michigan State. Last year, I had them predicted losing to Purdue, predicted getting beat pretty bad by Ohio State. And it was really hard to communicate. It was a really interesting challenge to communicate like, hey, Michigan State makes its money by running the ball against bad running defenses. That is not going to be good enough against teams that are good running defenses. They have to find a way to pass the ball on early downs. And so by creating kind of this expectation and this model that rewards those things, then we can kind of see, oh, those, you know, in a season, those cracks are there. Or maybe somebody like Baylor, who had a good season but really got a lot of bounces, you know, I don't know if you're going to go 5-1 and one score games again next year and get all those bounces when you lived and died by so much small margin. In terms of like a program sense, I think we entirely underrate how cyclical and developmental most of college football success is. So if you're not Dabo or Nick Saban, or I guess we'll throw Kirby Smart in there at this point because he got the ring. If you're not one of those guys, you're not competing every year for a national championship or even for a conference title. And so I love this idea of indicators for, hey, how do I know things are getting better? Of course, you think about Bobby Bowden of like getting crushed, then crushing losses, then winning. And so you can kind of measure by that. But I think a good way to look at this is kind of your bulk of experience and talent. In the past, I've looked at a returning talent index that looked at recruits and net transfers and weighted it for experience. And so you kind of get this idea of this bulk of where's the talent and how old is it? Because college is a game of development, right? And so even if the on-field results aren't great, if your talent is high and you're developing well and you get this massive talent, that's where you get a situation like Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern, where every 3 years they're in it, you know? And so that might be one of the things that I would look at is kind of where's your bulk of talent? Are you, if you're recruiting well, does that mean, hey, we've got to wait a couple of years for these guys to develop? Or have you recruited well and you're continuing to recruit well, but you've got this bulk of, you know, juniors and seniors who are going to be on the field? I think the simplest way for that is like, do you have a quarterback who's been decent for more than one season? That might be an indicator that you're going to take a step forward.
Thanks, man.
Excellent. Okay, you, Maxwell, we just saw you at it. Would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, hey, first of all, thanks, guys, for hosting this. This is really insightful and really cool. Parker, we've interacted a couple of times.
I apologize. I don't – if I said anything
mean. No, you're good. You're good. I was actually working through – you know, a master's in data analytics. So I was kind of just picking your brain, I think, through DMs and stuff like that. So the question I have, I know you kind of touched on it with, you know, not making a huge what to do about fourth down decisions, but my question kind of falls into that. You know, the old adage of if you want to win a game, three's not going to win. You need 7 points to win. I was trying to just rack my brain to figure out a way to sort of develop something similar to the, you know, the surrender punt index type of thing where, you know, how cowardly you are at when you're punting the ball in certain situations. My question kind of just stems from how would I go about trying to replicate or find instances of if you're kicking a field goal from inside your opponent's, you know, 10 yard line or 15 yard line or 20 yard line, what effect does that, if any, have as opposed to you winning the game? Because obviously scoring points is how you win football games. But at the same time, if you're only settling for 3 points in situations where you have a higher opportunity to get 7 points and you opt for the three, I guess, how would you go about kind of formulating that and using the data to kind of spit out an answer to you, just off the top of my head, anecdotally, I'm a state guy. So, the Michigan State game really stuck out to me because I mean, Michigan kicked 4 field goals in that game. And, you know, one of them was inside the 10 on they opted for like they didn't go for a 4th and 3 and they opted to kick a field goal. And there was a number of instances where they had short 4th downs inside the red zone, and they just opted to kick field goals, and you know, it ended up kind of biting them in the end. So I was just kind of seeing, you know, how that old adage and using data is to kind of, you know, look at those adages of like, you know, three.
Yeah. Oh, that was totally, sorry. That was super affirmative. I have a lot of ideas about that. That was not to cut you off at all. I think that's a great way to, that's a great question and a great model for how do we use data? Hey, I have an interesting question. Can I model it? And I think you did the right thing. You went to a specific game and kind of said, yes, this is something I'm thinking about. Well, how did it affect this specific game? I will say one, you have to be careful with anything points related and anything field position related, because you will come away with whatever work you do, you risk you risk coming away with the finding, hey, the team that scores more points wins, and hey, the team that has better field position scores more often.
Right.
But I think that you could look to start, you could do something. The way I would think about this problem is using expected points and looking at like just a simple choice model of if you go for it. So expected points from like 4th and 1 at the 20 is going to be, I don't know, like 2 something. And so basically you can look at, what's the implied probability of a team's like, what does a coach believe the probability of success is, right? Because if you choose to kick a field goal from fourth and one at your opponent's 20, you believe that the probability you make that field goal times three is greater than the probability that you get a first down times the expected points there, right? So you can almost come up with like an implied probability and say, okay, if they made this choice, that reveals that they believe their implied success rate in a fourth and one situation is, you know, X, 37% or whatever it is. And you can compare that to all of their other third, second, and short situations and say, on average, in power situations, a team was successful this many times, but this coach believes it's only successful in this time. Boom, you've got, you know, a difference between beliefs and reality. That's super informative.
Okay, cool. Just to follow up on just this, do you think within that formula, if kind of doing that same thing over and over again also has that compounding effect, that if you do it once, you can kind of get away with it, but if you're doing it three or four times, that could be the tipping point that would kind of lead you to maybe win or lose the game? Is that kind of a mindset?
Non-linearity, absolutely. There's like there's heterogeneous treatments there, and a field goal decision in the first quarter is not the same as a field goal decision in the fourth quarter.
Right.
I think that's totally true. I would say that's a second order question. I would try and not worry about the context. I would just say, again, you're like randomizing. DM me, but if you're randomizing, you say, hey, at any point on the field, at any down and distance, if you kick a field goal instead of go for it, what's the probability you believe you're going to be successful on the play that induced you to kick a field goal?
Okay. So good. Yeah. Well, just kind of start off with random, just take the context out of it. And then as you kind of lay that base layer to go in and add different points of context into it to see how that affects it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And right. Yeah, as you start kicking tires, DM me, I'm here.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
All right, we went slightly over an hour. This is our CFB Talk 45, talking advanced stats and college football with Parker Fleming. Parker, before we get out of here, I know that you just dropped a massive project last week. What is it? Where can we read it? And where can we find you this season?
My brain is so scatterbrained that I'm scrolling back. What did I drop last week?
Your previews back on the 12th.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So we're doing, I'll get to some previews for this fall. You can subscribe to the Purple Theory Substack. That's the TCU podcast newsletter. But I write some random stuff there when I don't have anywhere else to put it. Also my, BetUS college football will be starting up in the beginning of August, I think, and doing some, long-term predictions and all that. And of course, I'll be posting on Twitter as well.
Well, thank you so very much, Parker, for joining us. That was a really intriguing conversation. It was wonderful to hear a couple questions from the audience. And I know you have a great following. We were really impressed by the people who wanted to hear you speak on this as soon as we announced it, because I think it's an underappreciated area, advanced stats. And how it affects sports. So for all of you listening, thank you.